Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Don and Dude are here. Don and Dude are here. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. You're supposed to say it with me.
Oops.
You don't understand hip-hop cadence of 1986.
So it's tricky to rock a rhyme.
I'm here with Don. I'm Dude. And yeah, we love music. We love albums. We love talking about them. And that's just who we are. So got a great show for you today. We'll be continuing with our I Love the 80s journey. And Don and I are each going to present an album from 1986. The caveat assigned by the Wheel of Musical Discovery is that they had to be from the genres of pop and hip hop. So we'll be doing that. Of course, Don's going to be asking us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging, usually new releases and things of that nature. And then we will spin that wheel of musical discovery to learn what kinds of albums we'll be discovering in 1987, which is coming up next time. But this week, it's all about...
1986! That's what I'm talking about!
Velcro sneakers squeak across pastel-tiled malls as denim jackets and aquanet hair rule the scene. Cordless phones and answering machines feel futuristic on the kitchen counter, while glossy teen magazines stack up on coffee tables. Tom Cruise turns up the heat in the sky while Hulk Hogan bloodies King Kong Bundy in the steel cage.
Oh boy.
Today, one of us drops the needle on a classic pop album from 1986, and the other dives into a groundbreaking hip-hop release from that same year. So sort your garbage pail, kids, and hook up your brand new CD player. This is 1986.
A lot to unpack in 1986. A lot of kind of grown-up pop rock from artists that came up in the 70s, 60s and 70s, along with our parents, presumably. Paul Simon's Graceland.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Huge Grammy-winning, world music-infused, grown-up rock or pop. True Blue by Madonna, the big follow-up to Like a Virgin.
Papa Don't Preach.
I thought it was Papa's a Priest. I figured it out eventually, but I had it in my head that a priest had done the dirty. Control by Janet Jackson. I would have loved to have talked about this again, but we already did on the show. Love that record.
Also, I mean, I guess it's maybe more rock, but like Slippery When Wet by Bon Jovi.
Mm-hmm.
More in the R&B space, the Lionel Richie Dancing on the Ceiling.
Yep. Follow up to Can't Slow Down. Yep. Didn't love that record. I didn't like Say You, Say Me. I thought it was too gooey.
Yeah. And then, you know, of course, with hip-hop, Beastie Boys' License to Ill, which I think is officially the first hip-hop album I ever owned. I think it was an Easter gift.
Wow. That's appropriate.
Yeah. We also have Salt and Pepper.
Hot, Cool, and Vicious.
Yes.
All right. So, well, there was a whole lot to consider, of course, but, you know, the picks are in. We're going to do a flyby on 1986.
Mustang, this is Maverick requesting flyby.
Negative, Ghost Rider, the pattern is full.
Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
Iceman's not going to be happy.
You choose me?
My pick for a pop album from 1986 comes from Peter Gabriel.
Another grown-up popster.
Yes, very much. Peter Gabriel was born in 1950 in Surrey, England. Of course, he was the front man for Genesis in their early prog rock era. He left Genesis in 1975 and pursued a solo career. This album, So, is his fifth studio album. On this, he works with producer Daniel Lanois and guitarist David Rhodes. Well, let's start off with the opening cut. This is Red Rain.
What is he, Dexter? Blood spatter analyst.
I think it was originally going to be called Red Rum.
I had thought about that. But you can't sustain the Red Rum voice for an entire song.
So Red Rain was written by Gabriel, reportedly drawing on a recurring vivid dream involving a sea of red liquid, glass-like figures filled with blood, and a torrential downpour of red rain.
That's healthy.
Yep. you know, possibly rooted in a film called Mazo, in which villagers are punished for their sins by a blood red rain.
Or Raining Blood by Slayer. No, that came later.
Sure. but, it, you know, the themes, you know, have been interpreted as touching on fear, vulnerability, perhaps environmental damage, you know, like acid rain, nuclear fallout, and, you know, maybe even the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. Mm. This is a pretty big sounding opener, I think. You know, it starts out a little quiet and then it's like, boom, red rain. I like this for an opening cut.
I watched a documentary thing where Daniel Lanois said that when they started this project, specifically Peter Gabriel said that he didn't want any hi-hats. And Lanois said that he would only do it if they included some hi-hats, which are used here very effectively on this song. It's like shimmering hi-hat.
Yes.
Is that Stuart Copeland?
Yes. Yeah.
On that one? That's, okay, that's, drummer from The Police.
I read that as well. And so imagine like not even being brought in to do like the actual drums, but just the hi-hat.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it created that rain effect. Yeah. Tony Levin, the bass player on a lot of these, like I guess he would use chopped off drumsticks taped to his fingers to get that percussive growling low end thing. Huh. But this song feels like ritual. It's a heavy track without using any distortion or anything, but it's dark without the usual tricks.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Well, let's move on in the album. Here is Sledgehammer.
Don, I offer myself to be your sledgehammer should you ever need someone to break through the bullshit for you.
Is that what that means?
Take down those walls. I don't know. I feel like someone that will have your back.
Okay. I've only ever used the sledgehammer maybe to like break up like concrete and stuff. Or is that a jacket? No, that's a sledgehammer.
I've only used it to smash a car at a carnival where I paid some money to stand on the hood and smash the car.
Did you ever ring the bell at the amusement park or the fair?
I think the question would be, have you attempted to ring the bell?
That's
and
fixed.
Yes, I've made the attempt.
If the guy doesn't like you, he pushes a pedal that makes
it. I missed. I hit the ground. And I walked away.
So Sledgehammer was really, I think, the breakthrough single from this album, fueled, I think, in large part by the music video, which had like stop motion. I don't know if it was claymation. I mean, it was pretty.
There was claymation in there, too.
Yeah, pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, the that did drive it for sure. But, you know, what we didn't get to is Peter Gabriel's style while in Genesis and then even as a solo artist. Very performative, very theatrical. And I think that was kind of the modern way to do some weird shit. Because he used to do a lot of weird shit wearing flower costumes and
whatever.
Yeah, on stage. So. Yeah.
But the song I've really, you know, grown to love. It just really reminds me of Motown or like 60s soul, you know, the horns and stuff, you know, which is not typical of what Peter Gabriel was doing even in his solo career.
No, but I think those were things that he grew up on. They were influences, and he wanted to be able to tap into that. Now, at the same time, his ex-bandmate and drummer for Genesis, who became the lead singer for Genesis, Phil Collins, was having a lot of success also tapping into that, a little poppier.
Sure.
But tapping in, you know, into some Motown-y stuff. You know, these guys were getting in their 30s, probably getting a little nostalgic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, and I imagine, you know, Peter Gabriel fans, maybe some of them, you know, didn't like the pop sheen of some of these songs. But, I mean, lyrically, it's interesting, and it's, I don't know, I think there's more, you know, below the surface on some of these, like, poppiest moments.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think there's not, you can't dig much further on Susudio from Phil Collins from around the same time. Necessarily. I mean, maybe you can. I don't know. It hasn't touched me. But this song does, like, if you get past the video and whatever, it does feel like someone's committed to somebody else. Mm. And that's good.
All right, well, was there a cut you wanted to highlight on So?
Yeah, I think it's one I used to skip when I was younger because it was boring to me.
Kind of long.
Yeah, just like I didn't get it. I was not mature enough. That version of me, the kid when this came out, would have gone with Big Time, but instead I'm going to go with Don't Give Up.
The trees had burned down to the ground.
Now, admittedly, at the time, I also had no clue who Kate Bush was. If it wasn't Madonna or Cyndi Lauper, I wouldn't know who it was. But we all know now, especially Stranger Things fans. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she adds something very important to this song. So this one was written by Peter Gabriel. It's kind of the emotional centerpiece of the album, I would say. And I guess it's in response to 1980s Thatcher era, Britain's high unemployment and stuff. So just, you know, don't give up, life will get better, that kind of thing. Bassist Tony Levin, again, achieved the signature, quotes, tubby sound by using a diaper to mute the strings. But Gabriel sings the main despairing verses, while Kate Bush provides the woman's hopeful choruses in the dialogue structure. They use some drum machines, polyrhythms, some synths, and some Hammond-style piano. And I guess Gabriel was also inspired by Dorothea Lange's Great Depression photos that draw a parallel to this unemployment crisis in the UK. I guess Dolly Parton was invited to do this.
Yeah, and she said no.
Yeah. Well, Dolly Parton's more kind of really bright personality may not have worked as well to be the kind of working class tune that he was, you know, looking for. I don't know. Who knows? But the music video, him and Kate Bush are just in this embrace, mm-hmm. and they're not even looking at each other. And it's just them spinning around and he's singing his despairing parts and she's like comforting him.
Right. I just love the rhythm to it. You have that bass line and the little mm-hmm. drums. It's got kind of a world beat feel to it, but I could just listen to that all day. This is doom, 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 doom.
Yeah.
Doom, doom.
It sounded like they're doing the Night Court theme for a second there. but yeah, it's a great song. And I think, you know, in any hard times, this is a really wonderful thing to listen to kind of feel like there's some angel on your shoulder that's saying it's going to be all right.
This is something that I would usually kind of dismiss as being sort of trite, like, oh yeah, big deal, you know, don't give up, keep trying.
You're rich anyway.
Yeah, it. I don't know, for some reason, and maybe it's just because I like Peter Gabriel, I let him get away with this kind of thing, but I think it's an inspirational tune, you know, it feels sincere.
100%.
All right, so we arrive at the closing cut, and actually there's some...
Yes.
Yeah, there's some technicalities here. Well, so originally, I guess Peter Gabriel wanted In Your Eyes to be the final track on the album. But I guess because of the deep bass of In Your Eyes, for some reason, it wouldn't work at the end of the record, you know, because of the depth of the grooves or the something.
Yeah.
And so In Your Eyes got moved to the beginning of side one. And so that made the final cut. This is the picture, Excellent Birds. But when they did re-release it for the 25th anniversary, they did move In Your Eyes to the final cut.
I think it fits better there personally, but.
Yeah, but for so many years, In Your Eyes was in the middle.
Yep.
Anyway,
we've got to do it as it was in 1986.
So here's This Is the Picture, Excellent Birds.
Yeah, Lloyd Dobler should have held his boombox up with this instead of In Your Eyes. Crash and burn.
So this was co-written by Gabriel and Laurie Anderson. And I think that's Laurie Anderson's voice.
Yes,
on the record.
Again, I don't know who she is really.
Yeah. Apparently this song appeared on her album, her 1984 album, Mr. Heartbreak. But this was reworked for So. It's kind of more the avant-garde spirit that you get from Peter Gabriel. And, you know, again, embracing sort of world rhythms and mm-hmm. textures. I like it. I mean, I think it's very hypnotic, you know, the repetition. Actually, the final two tracks, the one before this, We Do What We're Told, and this, it is kind of like a kind of an avant-garde and experimental end to the record. But it still just sounds really good, though.
You know, yes.
His voice sounds great. There's a beauty to it.
Look, the production. The Lenoir was able to capture, and Peter Gabriel together, were able to capture these clean, sharp sounds, but somehow it all sounds very warm and organic. I'm not quite sure how they did it, but yeah, the song is weird, and it does end on kind of a wacky note.
Yeah,
it's almost like a grown-up Sesame Street segment about words and birds.
It is.
That's kind of what it felt like to me.
With like scarier Muppets, though. Like,
yeah. Well, she's whispering the stuff, and this is the picture. The bird. It's like, okay. So, yeah, it felt like some kind of wordplay game.
Yeah, but I think tracks like this kind of balanced the album because, you know, maybe it was in jeopardy of being a little too adult contemporary or a little too poppy.
Yeah, those bass strikes are cool, though.
Yep. And actually, there's some Nile Rodgers rhythm guitar on this track. He's got to be among the most mentioned people on our podcast.
Yes, deservedly so. The maestro of chic and yes. and that sound.
Also for you vinyl folks, you did not get this cut on the vinyl in 1986. So this was the era where, you know, I think we were starting to get CD and cassette focused.
Yep.
So this was omitted.
That's why I wasn't like it was kind of new to me this time around because I have the vinyl copy and that's typically what I listen to. Yeah, it threw me off.
Well, it's time to rewind and reflect on So. I'll begin with my clickbait headline. Gabriel hits the big time with challenging record everyone can love. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, artists, they just strike the right balance between challenging the audience, but also just making it like sound so good that it's palatable.
The balance of art and commerce.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is it. This is when it really works. And, you know, with the help of videos and I don't know, just maybe the nature of pop music at the time, it was just, it was perfect.
And his fan base by this point are gainfully employed.
Right.
Looking for ways to spend their entertainment dollars. And this is a perfect, you know, thing to be like, look, I'm so deep. So my clickbait headline to describe So, the album that made art rock a primetime MTV event. So was weird, expensive, and somehow a smash. Cost a little money to produce this one from what I read. The huge drums, bright synths, stadium hooks, but that human core and the cohesion that somehow spans these songs is crazy. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they are stitched together as well as they are. But basically, the overall vibe is the world is overwhelming. Love is complicated, and the only way through it is to keep moving. And that's kind of how this album feels, including moving into a lesson about birds at the end.
All right. Well, killer to filler. Well, I mean, there's some tracks we you know just have to mention.
Yes.
I mean, we did mention In Your Eyes, you know, which is a huge record, you know, made famous even more, I think, because of the scene in Say Anything that you alluded to with Lloyd Dobler holding the boombox outside his, what's her name? Ione Sky, her window. You know, it's a ballad, but there's more to it than that. It's got
way more to it.
Yeah. Just some weird tribal stuff underneath.
Well, if you watch any of the live performance of it, they really get into the African sounds throughout it, the chanting and the drums and like there's a whole dance routine thing. Mm-hmm. So at least from the shows in the 80s, I'm not sure that Mr. Gabriel is still doing that part, but just one thing about In Your Eyes, when I was college age, a cover of it by Jeffrey Gaines, an acoustic cover,
was
traveling around, and that's beautiful in a different kind of simpler way. So if you want to check that one out, I highly recommend that as well.
My favorite song on the album, I think the one that always, you know, kind of hits me is Mercy Street, you know, which is a very moody, dark sounding song, apparently inspired by Anne Sexton, the author who I believe committed suicide. But, you know, themes of memory, family, and loss. But another one that just has like a rhythm that's kind of hypnotic that I really enjoy.
Yeah, and then you get literary references, which is, again, leans towards the arty, smarty pants levels of the album.
I do like to pretend I'm smart.
I'm not a smart man, but I know what So is. Big time. I know it's satirical and it's about materialism and bragging that you're rich or whatever, but I like the vibe of it and I like feeling like I'm big time when I listen to it.
And that, you know, Sledgehammer and Big Time kind of sound like they're coming from the same place. It's sort of that 60s soul vibe, I think.
And then the last one I'll mention is What We Do, What We're Told, Milgram's 37, inspired by Stanley Milgram's obedience experiments. The song explores just blind compliance to authority.
Oh, that's the one where the people are like told to shock their coworker or friend or something.
Yes. Very cinematic, Floyd-y, Don. Mm-hmm. Very Wall-like to me. But again, it's pop sonically, but then it goes deeper and maybe there's some splashes of Bowie in there too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't call anything filler on this album.
No. I mean, the Birds one is the only one that comes to mind only because it wasn't part of my album experience until, you know. So I'm having to attach that on. It feels like an appendage.
All right. Production. I mean, you already talked about just, you know, what a great job they did and making this sound beautiful. You know, again, like there's a lot going on, but they make it sound inviting to the listener. No matter what you're listening to it, I mean, it sounds great on a super system, but it also, you know, sounds good on a little boombox.
I mean, I typically prefer the band in a room sound. This isn't a band, and this was intentionally designed like a cathedral, and it just fits the context of the era of what Lanois was doing, what he later did with like U2 and other bands by taking these sort of advanced sonic textures and making rock music and pop music more mature and more interesting at the same time.
It's all that time he spent with Brian Eno.
Yeah, that's right.
Replay value, what do you think?
More so now that I'm older. When I was a kid, I just liked those two hits, really. The rest of it was too groansy-upsy. And now I quite enjoy the entire thing. And when I'm in a contemplative mood or just feeling like I need a little lift, not a shot of adrenaline, just a lift, this is a great album for it.
Yeah. I mean, I listen to this album on a fairly regular basis. And it's actually also a good one when you have mixed company. Like, you know, if there are people who live through the 80s, they'll definitely appreciate it. But I think even younger people or people who like R&B, there's something there for everybody. And the legacy, well, it was the 80s. I guess I would give it credit for, along with the Paul Simon Graceland, for, you know, incorporating more African and Brazilian rhythms and stuff like that. You know, I think a lot of art rock kind of went into that sort of world direction. Talking Heads as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's generally remembered as a rare case of like an art-minded experimental musician crossing over to mass pop heights without simplifying or abandoning what made his earlier work distinctive, but throwing in some more fun sounding stuff, the more accessible things on the surface, like Sledgehammer, that made it one of the, you know, it's considered one of the best of the decade. It's good stuff.
Peter Gabriel so captured a moment when adventurous pop, global rhythms, and big hooks could all live in the same room. Pop it into your CD player and decide what it sounds like for you.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. All right, so 1986. There must have been some big musical developments or events. What can you think of?
Well, I mean, this is loosely musical, you know, in my opinion, because it was a big music icon. So the movie Labyrinth comes to mind from 1986. Like, the music from it is super memorable. I'm sure there's a soundtrack, but David Bowie stars in it as the Goblin King. And it's just a fantasy adventure story with Jim Henson's Muppet stuff when they were going a little darker with it. And there's some creepy stuff going on, but there's also fart jokes and, you know, the usual thrown in. But Bowie and his Tina Turner hairstyle, and he does some stuff with the magic crystal on his hands and whatever. And it just, his Bowie-ness was so there as the Goblin King. And he also, the codpiece, primo cod piece on the costume. You got, it's worth checking out the movie just for that. But just that blend of MTV and getting used to seeing our rock stars on the screen in movies and TV shows, and then, you know, there's musical numbers where he's singing several times. So the music video meets a Jim Henson movie. It's just so 1986.
Can you believe I haven't seen it? I'm actually kind of ashamed of it. Yeah.
Do watch it, man. I mean, it's weird.
I mean, I like Muppets. I like Bowie. You know,
Muppets and Bowie.
What was he at? Dark Crystals or something? Was that Muppet
Dark Crystal
too?
Was another Muppet. Well, I don't like that one as much. There's no Bowie. What about you, man?
Well, I feel like this would have been a better answer for you, but I'm going to say Sammy Hagar joining Van Halen. So I'm sure our listeners kind of know the story, but David Lee Roth left or was kicked out of Van Halen.
Depends on who you ask.
Yeah. And so, you know, in 1985, at some point, I think they announced that Sammy Hagar, formerly of Montrose and who had a solo career with mm-hmm. I Can't Drive 55, that he was going to be joining Van Halen. And so in 1986, the album 5150 was finally released. First single was Why Can't This Be Love? And I mean, it's not the first time a big band has replaced the lead singer. I mean, AC/DC had just done it a few years before under different circumstances.
And this was like they were at the height. They had just had the 1984 album, which was their biggest album. They could have just ruled the world and then they had to reset.
Yeah. And I'm not sure it's ever been as successfully done as this. And it isn't just a guy that's doing what the previous guy did.
No.
I mean, they became a different band. They still were Van Halen, but I don't, the songwriting changed, the tone changed a little bit.
It had a different energy, a more grounded energy than David Lee Roth,
yeah,
I think.
More grown up, I think.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
I mean, we're talking rock bands here, so these are incremental, baby half steps.
Yeah, and of course they tried it again later with what's his name, Gary Cherone.
Gary Cherone from Extreme.
Yeah, which I don't think I ever heard it, but
it's not great, but it's not his fault.
Right. Yeah, that was a different time, but yeah. Like imagine the Rolling Stones replaced Mick Jagger with
God. No, yeah,
with.
Steven Tyler,
sure.
just for the lips.
Right, what are some other significant musical events from 1986? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook, at Album Nerds.
All right, so I'm the hip hop guy, obviously, mm-hmm. homeboy. No, that didn't work. I went with a huge album from 1986, a world changing. Album in the music world in particular, Run DMC and Raisin' Hell. Run DMC, American hip hop group formed in Hollis, Queens, New York City in 1982 or 3-ish by Joseph Run Simmons, Daryl DMC McDaniels, and of course, Jason Jam Master Jay Mizell. He was the DJ. Unfortunately, Jam Master Jay was fatally shot in 2002, so their Run DMC does not really exist anymore.
By the way, Run is not related to Russell Simmons, right?
He is.
Okay.
And the group was originally managed by Russell Simmons of Def Jam Records, Run's older brother. So that one of the most influential hip-hop labels with young LL Cool J, etc. But Run DMC was setting trends in music and fashion. They were the first rap act to have videos on MTV, appear on American Bandstand, be on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, and perform at Live Aid, which we did talk about on an episode where we focused on Live Aid and their performers. Run DMC was among them. But the album, Raisin' Hell, is probably the most important rap hip-hop album, one of the top five, I would say, of all time. Why don't we jump into it for its crossover appeal, it's bringing hip-hop to the suburbs. This is the opening track, Peter Piper. Now, that's the beginning of the song, and I think it's important because of that that Bob James sample, mm-hmm. Take Me to the Mardi Gras, that ding, 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 that was used in, well, Beastie Boys used it, like everybody in hip hop has used that for the most part. And I think that's just so, it's weird that they are influential by using a sample that became influential because it was used by Run DMC.
Yeah.
So that opens the album with a kind of a fun Mother Goose themed rhyme scheme. It was really, I think, a way to say that they're part of folklore. They're heroes of the modern age, you know. They talk a lot about Jam Master Jay, call him the Big Bad Wolf. What'd you think of the opening, Peter Piper?
It's great. It's kind of quintessential classic Run DMC with the, you know, the back and forth delivery, or, you know, they're kind of taking turns, like finishing a sentence. You know, I enjoy that. And people don't really, not that I'm aware of, it doesn't seem like people do that anymore. You know, the style of rapping is, you know, evolved a lot over the years.
Yeah, I agree. And the use of drum machines mixed with the samples is also interesting. I think that's a level up in the sound. Steady beats and sharpness. In this case, I think it was a Roland TR-808. Ooh. I think you hear 808 used a lot in hip-hop songs of this era. So.
Yeah, that was like the original.
They say the word 808, so, or the number.
It's still a pretty minimalistic approach.
Yes.
I remember listening to that first Run DMC, and that was more minimalistic. So we're starting to add more layers here, but still pretty pretty clean.
Yeah, I think it just makes it, it's like the album's called Raising Hell. America at large is afraid of hip-hop. And it opens up with a nursery rhyme song, which is like,
yeah, I like that.
How harmful is this? It's not. Come on in. So I think it's a great opener and a fun way to kick things off. So of course, when speaking of Raising Hell, we've got to talk about this particular song that cracked it all open, that changed music and the trajectory of two careers. It's called Walk This Way. So, of course, that's featuring Aerosmith, Steven Tyler, and Joe Perry. Producers are Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons. The original 1975 version of Walk This Way by Aerosmith was produced by Jack Douglas. So, what the hell, man? I mean, they did a cover, and this started the crossover era, really, where you're taking a rock band and taking a rap group, and, you know, they were using the beat. Apparently, the members of Run DMC, especially Run and DMC, were saying that it was like this hillbilly gibberish to them, and they didn't get it because, you know, it's like, can't get laid and, you know, stuff like that. And they had to be convinced by Jam Master Jay and specifically Rick Rubin, who wanted them to do it live with Aerosmith. They recorded together in a studio. I guess the original title from Aerosmith was they saw the movie Young Frankenstein, and they really loved that scene with Marty Feldman where he's like, walk this way, and he's, you know, he's Igor, and then the guy walks like he's walking.
Walk this way.
And they took it and made it into a song. This way. But this is really all about that video. You know, when you see Run DMC with their Adidas and they're in two different studios from Aerosmith and they're bothering each other, like, I hate rock, I hate rap. Mm-hmm. And then the wall gets busted in by Steven Tyler, and then they're on stage together and it's this fusion. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and it's, I don't think it was one of those things where there was already mutual respect between the two artists. No. Like, I legitimately think Run DMC probably didn't even know who Aerosmith was, you know, or didn't care for it anyway. And I'm sure Aerosmith probably didn't care much about hip hop and, you know.
Oh, yeah. You know, they had been on a slide backwards. They were trying to reinvigorate the career. The band had some trouble, drug addiction, breakup, semi-breakup, where Joe Perry left for a while, and they were trying to get back on track, and they took a big gamble with this.
Yeah. And this is huge because, I mean, so much of early hip hop was sampling, you know, funk and R&B. And so, I mean, people had already, even Run DMC had already started sampling rock.
Yeah.
But I think rock became rich territory for hip hop artists.
One thing I found really, I was quite young, but I remember being struck in the earlier albums where King of Rock, saying I'm the king of rock and that kind of thing. And it's like, what? And then they're, you know, they always did lean on that, I guess, rock and roll mentality, you know, mm-hmm. like the dangerousness of it.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
It's still rock and roll to me.
Wow. But you should write a song about that.
The most important thing about this record is that it paved the way for that Beach Boys, Fat Boys collaboration.
Yes, thank God. Yeah. All right, Don, what song did you want to focus on here on Raising Hell?
Well, this is actually whenever I'm in a bar, I like to take over the jukebox now because it's all like digital and you can do it from your phone. And I noticed that whenever I play this song, you know, people, you just see people respond in the room. So here's It's Tricky.
You know, it's usually there's so much bragging in hip hop, including from Run DMC, about being the best.
Yeah.
But it's interesting they hear their, I mean, aren't they kind of saying
it's tough.
It's challenging to, to keep all this balance, do this juggling act.
Yeah. But it's kind of a humble brag though, right? Because yes. We're so successful. It's such a drag being famous.
It sucks being so good.
So It's Tricky was written by Run and DMC and also Rick Rubin. So I don't think I noticed before, but listening to it a lot this week, I'm like, oh, that is My Sharona.
Yeah.
Because especially the ding, ding, ding in there. It's kind of well disguised. In fact, I don't think they got sued by the Knack until the early 2000s.
Someone figured it out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of, I don't know if it was intentional, but it kind of feels like that, you know, that song Mickey. Oh, Mickey, yes. You're so, you know, it kind of is like the same sort of rhythm.
For sure. I think that was intentional. All right, so why don't we close out the album with the final track, Proud to Be Black. Probably the most political and historically dense tracks in their catalog, but certainly on this album, written by Joseph Run Simmons and Daryl DMC McDaniels, and Andre Brown, better known as Dr. Dre of Yo MTV Raps fame, was involved in that one, supposedly. It follows a 30-second beatbox intro, Son of Bifford, and it created sort of transition from personal family heritage, because that was about DMC's dad, I believe, and then it transitions into this kind of precursor to the conscious rap movement that would later be led by Public Enemy and KRS-One. And kind of the descendant to Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, from James Brown. What were your thoughts on this one?
I like it. And I guess I do wish maybe there was a little more of this like socially conscious stuff on the album.
That wasn't yeah. Where I was at yet. I mean, this was foot in the door into, I mean, they were making their way into more living rooms. But I think to put it on the end, if you get to the end of the album, right, that means you're really listening. Probably. Right. And it's an opportunity to maybe learn something.
So they started with Peter Piper and ended with Malcolm X.
Yeah, pretty much. But so it's like a encyclopedia of facts about Harriet Tubman, George Washington Carver, Jesse Owens, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., the tragedy of Emmett Till. So yeah, there's some heavy duty stuff in here, but still rhythmically carries you through. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, finishing out with a thinker, why don't we rewind and reflect on the album as a whole? I'll kick it off with my clickbait headline to describe Raising Hell. Are your teenagers raising hell? The secret behind the Adidas craze. Warning, this album may cause Adidas purchases, defiance, and sudden interest in rap music. And that's what happened. I mean, everyone suddenly was into rap. My elementary school, they were trying to force us to do an end-of-year rap about ourselves, where it's like, I'm jamming Jason and I'm here to say,
yeah,
I love my school in a major way type of stuff. Or suburban moms with wedge haircuts are trying to teach us how to rap.
Right.
Shit changed fast. And for the better or worse, I don't know. But this album made that happen.
Yeah, I remember, you know, kind of my classmates, like one year it was all like Twisted Sister and We're Not Going to Take It. And then suddenly the next year it was Raising Hell.
Mm-hmm.
So my clickbait headline is Run DMC, rock rhymes right on time for hip-hop revolution.
Nice.
Did you like that, how well I rocked that rhyme?
Yes. That was ill.
So, I don't know. Is this really, you know, could you point to this as being like the when hip hop went mainstream, or was, you know, where the revolution was really beginning?
I think so.
Commercial revolution.
Yeah. And now rap and hip hop are the predominant genres that are being listened to and streamed. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. It's got a punk rock energy. It's the rebellion of it. It's the newness of it at the time. It's something that your parents are going to hate at the time. You know, it was, those were all the ingredients.
And their style of rapping was very aggressive still.
Yes.
And it's,
yeah, not that party. It's not like we're here to party on the street. You know, it wasn't that stuff.
Right. And then, you know, this is before you get to people like Guru and Q-Tip, who have kind of a smoother, quieter delivery.
And there's one F word on the album. Go find it, which was crazy at the time. Killer to Filler. I don't really think there's any filler. I've read that maybe UB Illin could have been, just because it's sort of a dated terminology that people get now, but loved UB Illin.
I think that might be the first one I heard.
Yeah.
And I like the, you know, the Kentucky Fried Chicken references.
Yeah. Well, it's a story rap about people that are socially oblivious, like ordering a Big Mac at KFC or shouting touchdown at a basketball game. Some pop funk horns in it and stuff. But I remember like trying to use that term and like telling people, you be illin, man. It was quite embarrassing now, but I tried.
Yeah. Maybe like Dumb Girl, just,
yeah.
I like the point of it, you know, because I think they're, you know, you do have it's a cautionary tale, right, about a girl, but maybe calling a girl dumb just kind of feels not right.
It's basically, you know, if they were written today, it would be different, but the message is good. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my Adidas, I mean, it was part of their style, their calling card, and then making all the rest of us want to go buy Adidas shoes.
Did they ever get money from Adidas? I hope so.
They were doing a concert, and either Rick Rubin or Russell Simmons, probably Russell Simmons, invited people from Adidas to come to the show. And when they were performing My Adidas, they're like, hey, everyone take off your Adidas and hold it up. And they had this stadium full of people with their Adidas, and they did get a deal.
Nice.
That's what I heard anyway. Raising Hell, the title track, it's probably my favorite.
Yeah. Is that Back in Black? It kind of sat that sample, but I didn't see it credited, so it probably isn't.
I didn't either.
It kind of feels like Back in Black.
It could be inspired by it. Rick Rubin was involved. It's got distorted guitar. But yeah, this is there's a Kings of Rock vibe. This is a rockier song, and I do enjoy this one. There's a lot of guitar throughout on this record. Anything else stick out for you?
I mean, Is It Live? I think is cool. That's got a James Brown sample in there. Hit and Run, I like as well. It's all good.
Yeah. All right. So production wise, I mean, really, it's clean and punchy. The drum machines are sharp, and then the real drums that are worked in together, the instrumentation and the samples and the electronic stuff that was starting to be done all come together real nicely here. It's built for impact, and it succeeds.
Yeah. I read conflicting reports about, you know, to what extent Rick Rubin was responsible for all this, you know, the use of rock and stuff. Rick Rubin had done, I think, LL Cool J before this, and then he did this. And then next up was the Beastie Boys' License to Ill. So he's such an important part of, you know, this commercialization of hip hop.
Yeah. I heard somewhere that the Beastie Boys were hanging around the studio when this was being made, and some of the instrument stuff, the guitar stuff, bass stuff may have had them involved, but it's all legend. Replay value for you there, Don?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if I want a hip hop record from this era, this is the one I'd go to.
Yeah. And I think the Walk This Way is my opinion. I prefer it to the original from 75.
Yeah, I think I do too.
It's just truth. Legacy wise, we've kind of gotten to it. I mean, pop was getting bigger and shinier, but hip hop is getting louder and more culturally central. And it's the big bang of modern hip hop. Like, this is when creation started, I believe. And it paved the way for the Beastie Boys and the rock rap hybrid genre. And a lot of the music we hear today is the way things are just seamlessly blended together started with albums like this.
Yeah, I think hip hop was really, it was all about singles for a long time. And I think with Run DMC, even with their earlier albums, I think they were starting to, you know, look at
embrace the album format.
Yeah. And maybe this is them really, you know, having a great hip hop album.
So if you want the album where hip hop kicks the door off its hinges and refuses to close it again, Raising Hell is essential. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right, so on your voyage home, that was actually Star Trek IV came out in 1986, I believe.
Remember, oh,
they went back to 1986 to get the
whales or something.
Yep.
Oh yeah. God, that one sucked. No,
that's my favorite, I think.
What? I just because I like them being on. Yeah, I like them being in current times, but I didn't understand the whale stuff.
Had a very important message. Anyway, so on the voyage home, did you find anything else to dig?
I did. I'd been waiting for this one. I think I talked about it at the end of last year's one I was looking forward to. It's Jay Buchanan with Weapons of Beauty. Jay Buchanan is the powerhouse vocalist of Rival Sons, which I've mentioned numerous times, one of my favorite bands. But he's got a soulful blues rock delivery, good storyteller, and gritty and tender at the same time. The album is called Weapons of Beauty. And let's listen to a little bit of the title track.
Weapons of Beauty will destroy the night.
He was channeling Meatloaf there, I think.
Yeah, maybe. This is Jay's debut solo album, many albums with the Rival Sons. But it's Americana-leaning, produced by Dave Cobb.
Ooh.
Yeah, super producer of everyone, awesome. Leans on raw vocals, warm organic instrumentation, and you know the song Weapons of Beauty. I just like this. The Weapons of Beauty is the song, is the words, and being able to change the world with song. I like that.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
You better. And then because it's 1986 and I have a vinyl collection, I do like to try and pick something from the year we're talking about, and I went with Peter Gabriel's nemesis, Genesis, and their 1986 Invisible Touch album. English rock band evolved from progressive rock pioneers into big pop rock act of the 80s, led by Phil Collins and Tony Banks and Mike Rutherford. Let's listen to a little bit of
Land of Confusion.
Yes. That one gets a little hard rockier than some of their other stuff. I loved this record at the time, and if I had been pressed for Phil Collins or Peter Gabriel, I would have taken Phil Collins all day back then. But right now, I feel like they have their places, and they're both important.
I remember the video had those spit and image puppets.
Yeah, those rubber sort of realistic, creepy-looking puppets from Britain.
Yeah,
it was a dark video, dark song, and only if you really pay attention. But on the surface, it just sounds fun. But that's a great example of that grown-up pop-infused rock of the mid-80s. What you got there, Donnie?
Well, I'm going to be reviewing a couple of records on a different podcast, the New Wave Music Podcast, which I've mentioned several times before.
Yes.
And so...
I've seen the text, Don. I know what's going on.
Well,
Jay accuse.
So one of the records, both of these are kind of lost. So Susanna Hoffs, 2024, released something called The Lost Record, which were from sessions recorded in 1999 in her Los Angeles garage, right around the time she was expecting a new baby. It was a time when she was kind of exploring her sound outside of the Bangles. She was hanging out with like the Sheryl Crow crew. So it kind of has that vibe.
Getting Lilith fared.
Yeah, I think so. here's a song called November Sun.
Is that after the November rain?
I think it's her response to Axel.
There we
go. Yeah.
I would like to hear Axel do that.
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. So some of the songs are kind of acoustic like that. Some of them are, a little more rockin', but mostly stripped down, kind of has a garage feel. Okay, and another record, Kirsty MacColl, who's an Irish singer, actually, you know, was the wife of Steve Lillywhite. Mm. She's the Irish singer on the Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues. You know, it's become a holiday favorite. She recorded an album in 1983 that Polydor scrapped. This was going to be her follow up to her debut record. You know, this album was deemed not commercial enough. It's been released under the title Real, and here's a song called Camel Crossing.
Sounds like she was trying to do like a Talking Heads kind of thing here.
There's definitely some Bowie-sounding stuff, and yeah, maybe some Talking Heads. It was actually a pretty big departure from her debut, which was more guitar-driven, and this is really a synth-pop album. I really liked this album a lot. I can't believe it wasn't released at the time, and you know, I wonder if her career path would have gone a little differently.
Probably.
But definitely check it out. It's Kirsty MacColl, Real. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about the time on the show, and I'm reminded of the words of the iconic characters Maverick and Goose, played by Tom Cruise and Anthony Edwards in the 1986 film Top Gun, which I saw way too many times. And they said, I feel the need
for speed.
You fucking suck.
I was trying to be in sync with you, so I slowed down.
I feel the need
for speed.
You are no goose to my Maverick. God.
Sorry.
With that in mind, let's bring out the wheel of musical discovery to find out what kind of albums we'll be discovering in 1987.
Next time, we continue our I Love the 80s series with 1987. Heartfelt twang and arena-ready riffs share the spotlight as we dive into country and rock, featuring two albums that capture the grit, gloss, and growing crossover power of the late 80s.
So we'll be looking at country and rock.
Will we finally get to George Strait?
We'll see. Maybe. Yeah, there's some good stuff in 87, but we talked about so many 87 albums in the past that we're going to have to find some new avenues.
Well, what's your favorite record from 1987 or 1986? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And please visit albumnerds.com where you can listen to all 326 episodes. And the best way to support this show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time. 87's waiting.
All right. This show debuted in 1986.
I'm supposed to guess the theme song?
Yes. Come on in and pull yourself out a record.
God.
Let the fun begin. It's time to drop the needle.
That's Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yes.
I heard a rumor that was Cyndi Lauper that did that, but uncredited because the record label wouldn't let her. I don't know. It could be.
It kind of has that vibe.
Yeah. You sounded more like Edith from All in the Family.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Those were days. No, I'm not doing it. See you next time, y'all.